Court will proceed to the third case of the day, the United States versus Cunningham. Mr. Marsh.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Mr. Minkler. I am Bill Marsh. I am the attorney for David Hardin in this case, this consolidated appeal, but I'm speaking at this point on behalf of all three defendants. In addition, Mr. Hardin, defendant Larry Williams, who's represented by Ms. Schneider, and defendant Herman Cunningham, who's represented by Mr. Schur. My client, Mr. Hardin, is serving 25 years in prison. Mr. Williams is serving 35 years in prison, and Mr. Cunningham is in prison for the rest of his life, following a trial which we contend was not a fair trial for two reasons. First of all, the district court deprived these defendants of a fair trial by combining the guilt-innocence decision, which is the essential function of the jury, with sentencing determinations, which, as we now know, were determinations that should never have been submitted to the jury. Together with that, the defendants were significantly prejudiced by the district courts allowing government witnesses to testify about the procedures for obtaining a Title III wiretap.
Was there any suggestion at that time that it be held out of the presence of the jury? In other words, that the examination of that witness be held out of the presence of the jury so the judge can determine whether or not it could be admissible, the tapes?
Your Honor, that was not considered. There was an objection to that evidence, and the objection then was, and I think still is today, that the jury just should not have heard that evidence.
We have a lot of out-of-presence of the jury determinations as to admissibility of evidence. Why? I don't quite understand why it was had to be done in front of the jury to determine whether or not it's admissible.
I think the judge determined that it was admissible at the time the evidence was proffered to the jury. It was objected to.
Well, didn't they have to lay a foundation for it? That's where your objection lies, the foundation that led to the admissibility of the evidence, right?
No, I don't think it's a foundational problem, Your Honor. The problem is this evidence is strictly goes to a question of law, not a question that should be submitted to the jury. The government had obtained Title III intercept orders, so there had been a motion to suppress, which had been denied, and so all proceedings in the district court which should have taken place with respect to that issue had taken place. And the jury never should have heard that the U.S. attorney approved of this. The U.S. attorney thought these people were drug dealers.
At what point did Judge Barker say, yes, it's admissible, these tapes are admissible?
No, the argument here doesn't go to the tapes. Prior to the trial, defendants filed a motion to suppress all of the tapes on the grounds that the Title III intercept order violated the Fourth Amendment. Right. That was denied in a motion by the judge, in an order by the judge prior to the trial. What's being objected to here is the fact that the government witness was allowed to testify that in order to get that intercept.
I know, maybe we're talking by each other. Yeah. But why? We do this in other situations where the jury doesn't have to hear whether or not the proper procedure were used to get it, whatever it is. Why wasn't that done without in the absence of the jury?
I can't answer that, Your Honor. I don't know.
Do you think that would have worked?
My position then was, Your Honor, and is today, that under no circumstances should the jury have heard the procedure for obtaining.
Well, that's what I'm saying, that the procedure used that validated the warrant was no business of the jury.
Right.
And couldn't that have been done out of the presence of the jury, and then you just go on using the tapes without having heard the jury heard the.
Right. Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that there weren't any facts that the judge needed to know to rule on the admissibility of the procedure. The procedure is well known by all.
I thought you said he'd already ruled on it.
The judge had already ruled that the order was properly obtained by the government.
That's true. Ruled on admissibility of the tapes.
The judge had ruled that the tapes were admissible, yes.
Then there was nothing. I mean, I'm just puzzled the way Judge Kenney's. Did the defendant, the defendants making an issue about the tapes?
Other than the motion to suppress, and that issue was then preserved at trial and is not being pursued here, but the objection that is being raised At this point,
I understand. My question, that's not my question. Did the defendants make any issue at trial about the tapes? Did they say, oh, these tapes, you know, where these tapes come from and who approved them and all that sort of stuff?
No. The only objection to the tapes was the Fourth Amendment objection, which was ruled on prior to the trial. But in addition to the problem with the Title III procedures, and let me just emphasize, Judge Kaney, because I think we are talking past each other. The objection here is this witness, Special Agent Dooley, testified that in order to get the intercept order, the DEA higher-ups had to approve it, i.e., Mr. Hardin's a drug dealer. Mr. Hardin was the first intercept target. The United States attorney had to approve it, i.e., he believes Mr. Hardin's a drug dealer.
Was this evidence used in the motion to suppress, to overcome the motion to suppress? In other words, did the government say, well, look, we went through all these steps as we're supposed to do by law?
Right.
In the motion to suppress?
Yes. In briefing. Oh, that was all done briefing.
Right. But, I mean, the judge had, Judge Barker had before that information.
Yes. Right.
And your objection, then, as to why this came back again in the course of the trial?
Yes. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So what you're telling me is no reason to have it heard outside the presence of the jury because it had already been heard and there was no reason for the jury to receive it.
Right. The admissibility of the tapes was not an issue at that moment in the trial. That's exactly right. The other issue, Your Honor, is this is a fairly unique case which came between the Blakely opinion and the Booker decision of the Supreme Court. It was after the Booker decision in this court, but before the Booker decision in the Supreme Court. Since I'm about out of time, I don't want to infringe my colleague's time. I would just emphasize a point made in our reply brief, which is that this is not the same case as the Peters case. Peters was a case in which the issues being discussed here were not raised in the district court, and it was a plain error standard. In this case, the government has acknowledged that this was error, and the only real issue is whether it's harmless error. As the court's well aware, the burden is on the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to this court that it was not harmless error. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Marsh. Ms. Schneider.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Tina Schneider. I represent Larry Williams. We're here today because the court denied Mr. Williams his constitutional right to represent himself. He asserted his right before the jury was chosen, and so he asserted it in a timely fashion. The question is not whether he could have theoretically asserted it before that time. The only question is whether he did so before the jury was chosen. Secondly, the motion to represent himself was not made for the purposes of delay. Some 2 weeks after Mr. Williams asked to represent himself, he renewed his request. He renewed it several times. At that point, the judge said, oh, by the way, when I denied it the first time, when it was made before the jury was impaneled, I denied it because I found it was for the reason of delay, the purpose of delay. But if we look at what the judge did and said at the time Mr. Williams made his first timely request to represent himself, the judge said exactly why she denied his motion. She said she denied it because she felt Mr. Williams was frustrated and angry. She thought proceeding, representing himself would not be in his best interests, and so she was giving him, in essence, a cooling off period. Those reasons, while they may have been motivated by the judge's desire to see Mr. Williams get a good defense, under law, those are not sufficient reasons to deny a defendant's timely request to represent
there
himself.
There is no prohibition from the judge supplementing what she thought at the time, saying, well, I probably should have made it clearer, right?
Is there? If there were some basis for it. However, here we have Mr. Williams making his request, and there's quite a lengthy interchange between the two of them about, you know, why he's doing it, what he wants, and what she is seeing and why she's ruling the way she is ruling. And if you look at the record as a whole, it is clear that this is not a judge who minces words. She says what she thinks. And she said at the time that she did not feel it would be in his best interest to represent himself. She said at the time that she felt his lawyer was doing a good job. And she said at the time that he was making the request out of his frustration. That is why she denied the request.
Does he complain about how his lawyer did at the trial?
On this appeal?
Yes.
Not specifically. During the trial, he, when he renewed his request, he made complaints about how his lawyer was doing. And at the beginning of the trial, when he made his initial request, he complained about how his lawyer was doing. Our position here is not that, oh, he should have been allowed to represent himself because his lawyer did a poor job. In fact, that's irrelevant to
and
the...
And that was so preposterous, right?
What, excuse me?
It's so preposterous. He was convicted with a lawyer, now he's going to represent himself.
He's
going to have a great shot at acquittal, right?
Except Ferretta makes clear, and the Supreme Court makes clear.
I know, it's just so ridiculous.
Well, that's why... The purpose of the right to represent yourself is not to give defendants a better chance.
Not to win your case.
It is to respect
what?
To respect someone's personal autonomy. We make it clear that even though this we may think this is foolhardy.
But that's ridiculous. Look, because you're not a lawyer, Williams. He's not permitted to hire a non-lawyer to represent him, right?
That is correct.
Well, that impairs his autonomy.
You are allowed to make the decision that if your life is at stake and you want to represent yourself, the Constitution gives you that right.
But so if my life is at stake and I don't want a lawyer, but I want to have my pal, who I think is smarter than any lawyer, then my autonomy is equally impaired.
The court has held that out of our respect for what the defendant...
Yes, respect should be for the defendant's judgment. If he says, I want to be represented by this person, who's in fact an excellent lawyer, happened to be disbarred, but he's an excellent lawyer. And he would do a much better job either than I myself or some lawyer that court would give me.
But that's not the law, Your Honor.
I know it isn't. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, the law
is... I thought maybe you'd explain it, it makes sense. Then I'd feel good, right? Because you're enforcing sensible law rather than asinine law. But apparently you can't.
Well, that right is not absolute, is it?
It is not absolute if it is raised after jury selection, certainly. It is not absolute if it is raised in the middle of trial. At that point, the judge has discretion to weigh the interests of the defendant in his personal autonomy and his right to represent himself versus the potential for the disruption of the trial. And
I don't understand the logic of that. Suppose the person requests his right of self-representation after the jury is selected, and then the judge says to him, oh, look, if you want to do that, you know, it's your funeral because I'm not going to give you a continuance. You know, I don't do anything like that. And, you know, but if that's what you want, why would there be any limitation except mental competence if this autonomy business is to be taken seriously?
Well, the judge could certainly say there's no bar on the judge allowing a defendant to represent himself at any stage. The judge could say, and there are cases where the judge lets a defendant step in after that point. The question, though, was, is the right absolute? And after there's jury selection, the right is not absolute.
Why not?
Because of the concerns about judicial economy and judicial integrity. Are we going to waste too much of the time getting the defendant up to speed, or is the jury going
to
be confused?
To the defendant, look, your request is belated. That puts you at an even worse disadvantage because I'm not going to give you any time to get up to speed.
Mm-hmm.
But suppose the defendant says, you know, I read Ferretta and listened to Ms. Schneider, and in the exercise of my autonomy, even though I know I'm going to be convicted, I want to represent myself. And I'm not asking for a continuance or anything like that. What basis would the judge have to refuse his request in that case?
The law is that the judge has discretion after the jury is selected, or at any time once the jury starts getting selected, to weigh the potential disruption of the case and factors such as the competence of the defendant's lawyer.
But we had a case here where the jury was at the door coming in the courtroom. I don't think our case law has a bright line exactly as you want to draw it, where they have to.
Actually, I believe it does. That,
well, I wrote the Oki case, and I don't remember being that precise on it.
If the jury... sorry, I'll find it here somewhere. The Johnson case, for instance, says, point blank, the motion is timely if made before the jury is impaneled. Cosmel, also of this...
But we haven't gone the other way to say, no, they're at the door coming in, and therefore... It's too late?
It's never too late. All I'm saying is your right is not absolute after that point. I mean, a judge can grant a defendant the right to represent himself. The judge has discretion to do that at any point. What I'm saying here is my client made his request before the jury was chosen. So certainly at that point, his right was absolute, and it should have been honored.
Thank you. Mr. Scherr?
Your Honor, I deserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal. And I joined the arguments made by Mr. Marsh.
All right, so you just seek rebuttal time then?
Well, I may or may not, or I may give my time to Mr. Marsh.
All right.
I was really going to argue on the Title III point, and I think Mr. Marsh covered it more than anybody. I don't want to use the court's time.
All right, well, I certainly don't want to preclude you, though, if you. All right. Mr. Minkler?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Josh Minkler, and I represent the United States of America. I want to follow up on Judge Kaney's point regarding the admission of the Title III evidence. Mr. Marsh is, of course, correct that he did not at any time challenge the admissibility of the wiretap evidence based on foundational elements. The motion to suppress did not specifically deal with the foundational elements. I believe it dealt with whether there was sufficient probable cause. Those two things being said, let me submit to you that in the limited purpose it was done here, that it is appropriate for the jury to hear that foundational element. In any investigation, criminal investigation, I think the government conduct is questioned. It was in this case, not with respect to the wiretap, but it was.
See, that's the problem. That there were no objections made to the admission of the tapes as such, except the foundation part of it. Why does the jury need to hear the foundation?
What I'm suggesting to you, Judge Kaney, is that when government conduct is questioned overall as part of a defense, the government should be allowed to say...
There was an argument that the tapes were somehow improperly obtained?
No, there was no argument to that nature, none whatsoever. The government conduct was questioned in other areas. Why didn't you arrest my guy at this point if you knew he was dealing heroin? Why didn't you tape my guy at this point? What I guess was trying to do, in maybe rather crude fashion, was to submit at least to the jury that, look, there are constitutional legislative requirements and that the government conform their conduct to those requirements.
I mean, I could see doing that if they're attacking the tapes themselves, but once they're deemed to be validly obtained, why vouch for them through testimony, or at least how you went through getting them?
Well, my thought process is, and obviously this is anecdotal, I have nothing to support it, but I believe that the typical federal court juror presumes that the government just arbitrarily decides to wiretap somebody's phone. And I wanted to explain to them at least that there is some application process and that it was followed. It was not, as is suggested by the appellants, to infect the jury with probable cause determination. I believe Judge Barker clarified that by saying, look, he's just talking about the application process as he understands that.
Yeah, but I mean, what the panel of three lawyers at Justice who looked over it, you know, isn't that sort of vouching for how good the evidence is?
That's certainly one inference that could be drawn. That was not what I was trying to do, and I don't think that was argued in any way in closing argument. I don't think it was mentioned. It was certainly just there was an application process which was followed. Let me also submit to the court that in this case, as well as the wiretap evidence, there were six co-conspirators who also testified who did interpret the calls and say, yeah, these are the guys we were dealing drugs with. There was physical surveillance of the drug deals. There was a search warrant executed, which recovered some evidence of drug dealing. There was a confession by one of the defendants that was admitted into evidence. So the evidence about the probable cause determination, I would submit to you, was very minimal. If any, and at least would be, if error, harmless.
Your first argument, the government, the jury might question the government's conduct. We've been hearing, you know, wiretap evidence for many, many, many years, and occasionally, you know, there are arguments that, well, you edited something out, or, you know, it was altered, there wasn't a chain of custody, all that stuff. That's fine, but I don't think jurors are naturally skeptical about wiretap evidence. On the contrary, it's great evidence, right?
Well,